Now, if you would, as you are able, let's stand together for the reading of the gospel. Now, after they had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night and went to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they are no more. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He will be called Nazarene. The gospel of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. He woke up with a start, his breath ghosting in the night air. It had happened again, another dream. The moonlight shivered on the floor. He shuddered and closed his eyes. He was too jumpy. It was just a dream. A dream, he reminded himself. He replayed it in his mind. "Egypt," he whispered. The word felt strange in his mouth. Were they really supposed to travel all that way? Maybe he wasn't getting enough sleep. Or maybe it was that dinner she had made last night. Was it overcooked? Or undercooked? He closed his eyes and he saw again the angel, the silvery robes, the liquid voice. "Get up. Take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt." It was ridiculous. What would they do in Egypt? How long would they stay? Was he going crazy? Was this some strange delusion? But what if it was true? What if Herod was looking for the boy? The boy was laying at their feet, sprawled across his mother's legs. This little boy, the one who was always taking his chisel or his hammer and running off or playing peekaboo. This boy, he was crazy. He was crazy, and the woman was crazy, and the boy was probably crazy too. For crying out loud, the donkey they rode here on was probably insane. She rolled over. She looked at him with those eyes, those deep pools of knowing. They swallowed him all at once, and she knew everything that was inside him, all his thoughts and agitations, and these worrisome dreams. He swallowed. He looked deep into those deep pools. "I had a dream." She touched his face, reading it, translating every line on his brow, reading each glimmer of his iris. "It's not safe," he said, trying to steady his voice. She nodded. "We've got to go," he said. She looked at the boy strewn across her legs. She reached down and touched his hair. "When?" she asked in a whisper. He swallowed. "Now. We've got to go now." Mary laughed. When he didn't respond, her face fell. "Right now? In the middle of the night?" She read the concern on his face. She looked around the tiny room. "I suppose we can pack and make it to Elizabeth's by nightfall." "Not Elizabeth's." She looked back at him, questioning. There was a long silence while he tried to remember how the strange word felt in his mouth, while he tried to form it again. "Egypt," he said. She put her hand to her mouth. "I had another dream. It's the king. He's going..." He looked down at the boy. She grabbed the child and pulled him to her instinctively, rocking, her dark hair wisping over his brown shoulders. He groaned and squirmed, but settled into his mother's embrace. After a few minutes, she stopped rocking. "Okay," she said. They got up and began to pack. What happened? It seems like we were just singing songs with the angels, celebrating the coming of a king who would turn the empire on its head. A new king who welcomed ragged shepherds and foreigners at his throne. We were all excited and ready for a revolution. But now the songs have turned to whispers as the Holy Family slinks off in the dead of night to get away from the inflated ego of a self-absorbed demagogue. Now, on this road in the middle of the night, that's when the questions really begin. What have I gotten myself into? Did I take a wrong turn? Did God forget to include a few people on the whole peace on earth and goodwill memo? Why does this egomaniacal lunatic get to ruin things? Why send all those angels for a sing-along and not for a revolution? Well, I'm sorry. We're not going to find any satisfying answers this morning. Instead, just know that this isn't a new thing. Even Jesus was met with resistance from the very beginning. God's light was born in darkness, and it's right at home there. At the age of 3, in his home country of Panama, Franco fell several stories and landed on his head. He was in a coma for about a month after that. At the time, the doctors didn't have much hope, and they simply packed Franco's head with ice and they waited. Now, amazingly, he recovered, but he was unable to speak. School was a challenge for Franco, but he developed amazing artistic abilities. He began to use his skills as an artist to relate to others, drawing pictures of kids at school to make friends. And at the same time, a local artist began giving Franco speech lessons. Eventually, Franco moved to New York. There, he continued working as an artist under the name Franco the Great. Using his talents to beautify the world around him. He's traveled the globe now and met the likes of James Brown and Nat King Cole and Muhammad Ali. And while he could have spent his time questioning why he was so unfortunate to suffer this debilitating injury, Franco decided to make art out of the darkness. He brought light. Because God was not the author of his misfortune. God did not promise an easy road either. Jesus didn't say, "Follow me and I'll make things easy," or "store up for yourselves treasures in heaven so that you'll have a steady job and great benefits all the days of your life." But there is one guarantee, and it's right there in Isaiah that we read earlier. It was no messenger or angel, but his presence that saved them. In his love, he redeemed them. He lifted them up and carried them all the days of old. Presence. Not a removal from hardship or suffering, but presence alongside us in the midst of hardship and suffering. Her needle sailed through the cloth like a fishing boat slipping through waves or a new plow cutting earth. If she didn't look up, she could get lost in the thread, even forget where she was. She could go back to her little village. Every morning she woke up there. Lost in the bliss of forgetfulness, back in Galilee with her family, and every morning it hit her again. This was not home. She was far away, a refugee, waiting until she could go back and start her life again. But if she stayed here with the needle and thread, skipping and skidding through the fabric, she could be home again. The smells of cinnamon and coriander wafted in from the street, and she was pulled out of her reverie. He should have been back by now. She got up and went to the door. The people were knotted in the street, tangled up like snarls of old thread. The boy was nowhere to be seen. She closed her eyes and listened for him, but all she heard was the haggling of merchants and the shuffling of sandy feet on the hardened dirt. She held her breath, listening harder. And then she heard it. Her son's voice strained and whimpering. She scanned the street and found him stumbling toward her. "What's wrong?" He shook his head and closed his eyes, but the tears he was holding back freed themselves, and he heaved sobs into her embrace. "Shh," she quieted him. She whisked him into the house and pulled him onto her lap, inspecting him for injuries. "What's this?" she said, turning his head to the side and looking at the reddening skin around his right eye. "What happened?" He was going to speak, but the tears came instead, and he screwed up his mouth to hold back the sobs. Then he pulled the sack up to his chest and looked down at it. She eased the sack from him and opened it. There was a little grain, but it was mixed with dirt and pebbles. "Oh, son," she said, "what happened?" That was supposed to be their grain for the week. She could sift out the dirt, but so much was missing. "Do you have the rest of the money I gave you?" He covered his face and shook his head. She put the sack down and pulled him in close to her. When he quieted, she asked him again, "What happened?" He wouldn't speak. She needed time to think, so she sent him to his father's shop. She sifted the grain into a large bowl, separating out the dirt and rocks. It wasn't nearly enough, barely half of what they needed. What would they do for food? There was a rap at the door, and it was Kia. She stood in the doorway with her boy, Rennie. He held a reddened cloth over his nose, looking down at his feet. Kia held a large bowl. The boy stood quietly while his mother explained how he had been bullied by some boys in the market, and while they were beating him, Mary's boy had come over and stood between Rennie and his attackers. So the boys took to beating him instead, knocking the sack of grain from his hands and spilling it in the street. She held out the bowl. Mary took it. It was filled with grain. "Will you have enough?" she asked. "Yes, yes, please take it," Kia said. Mary thanked them and invited them in. Now the Magi's gold is spent. The myrrh is traded for diapers. The frankincense for rent. And Mary, Joseph, and Jesus have found themselves in a strange place. They don't know who is friend or foe. Will someone find them and turn them in? Will they be mistreated because of their ethnicity or religion? Should they keep others at arm's length and stay quiet so they won't be profiled or made an example? Now those angel songs are so far away, the tune is hard to remember. The odd shepherds, just a figment. The vigils from aged astrologers, a hazy dream. Did any of it really happen? Was it some great hoax? Or did we misinterpret the message? What if God's kingdom isn't like the empire we know? What if God's kingdom isn't about imposing power from above, but rather infusing justice and generosity from below, like yeast working through the whole batch of dough? God's kingdom is the opposite of empire. God's peace is not the Pax Romana. Peace by power or peace by sharpened steel. God's peace is the peace of presence. Peace that stands beside the hurting, the outcast, the foreigner, the bullied, the afraid. God's peace is the peace that gives strength to speak out when human rights are violated or when a person's dignity is trampled. God's peace is the peace that challenges our fears of the other and helps us open our hearts and our doors and our tables to those who need refuge. God's peace is not the peace that quietly sits where it is told. God's peace is the peace that resists when any person, regardless of race or creed or sexual preference or status or gender or education or ability, is told that they are less than human. God's peace doesn't need the empire's approval or power to stroke its ego. God's peace is content with small acts of justice, with tiny acts of kindness that work through the whole mess, cups of cold water and visits to jail cells and hospitals. God's peace is fine with the slow and lasting progress of change at the molecular level. After he overcame a debilitating head injury, Franco became a world-renowned visual artist in New York City. He's most famous for his work on the streets of Harlem. After the assassination of Martin Luther King, a lot of stores in Harlem had security gates installed. To Franco, these so-called riot gates made the street look like a prison. So he offered to paint a mural. Soon the idea caught on, and he painted mural after mural on these gates, transforming them into works of art. Now, murals on gates may not seem earth-shattering. But Jesus isn't calling us to build an empire. The empire is just fine. Jesus is calling us to transform the things around us. Transform conversations by really listening. Transform attitudes with words of encouragement. Transform neighborhoods by planting a garden. Transform fears by sharing a meal. The sun glinted off the chisel in the boy's hand. Joseph squinted and rubbed his eyes. The image of the angel reverberated in his head, shimmering, blue-tinged light gleaming all around. Things should be different, but they were just the same. They had packed up their few belongings, moved all the way back home to this tiny podunk village, and now what? He still felt like a refugee. He looked back at the boy who was working on a table leg. He was good with the wood. He knew when to go easy and when to push on through. He knew just what each piece could give and managed to bring out the best in it. Still, he needed some guidance from time to time. There was a knot in the piece that the boy was working with, and Joseph walked over to show him, but the boy navigated the gnarl, easing round it and incorporating it into a cut. The leg was a little larger at the top, slightly imperfect, but beautifully balanced. The knot had become interesting, captivating even. Mary came to the doorway with their baby girl on her hip. She bounced the smiling child who squinted and giggled in the afternoon sun. Joseph smiled and watched the little one pull at her mother's hair until Mary let out an ouch that made the baby squeal with delight. The happy scene was interrupted by the clangs of centurion armor clamoring up the street. The soldier came to a stop in front of them, the plume of his helmet casting a shadow across the boy's work. The boy looked up. "Not bad," the centurion remarked. "You have some promise." Joseph squeezed his fists tight, staring at the soldier, silhouetted in the late afternoon sun. Mary hummed. She hummed a tune she hadn't hummed in years, one that she used to sing when she was still carrying the boy, one about God blessing and raising up the poor and casting down the powerful. His daughter cooed, and she was transported back to that stable so long ago. He heard songs of angels. He heard the awed voices of shepherds looking for a king. "My father was a craftsman," the soldier said. "Give me a go, will you?" The boy set out a new piece of wood on the bench. He handed the centurion the chisel and stepped aside. The soldier ran the chisel across the wood, but it only skipped across the top. On the next pass, he gouged the wood and lodged the chisel deep. With some effort, he dislodged the tool, chuckling with unease. He made another pass, hanging on the gouge he had just created. Frustrated, he forced the chisel through, but it slipped and dug into his other hand. He cursed, dropping the chisel and grabbing his bleeding hand. The boy handed the centurion a rag, then he picked up the wood. He gentled it in his hand, then leaned in, his ear next to it, as if it might whisper to him. The centurion seemed to forget his injured hand and watched. Then the boy started to work. The shavings rose and twirled and fell off with each pass. After a bit, another leg took shape, and the boy offered the chisel to the soldier. The soldier was reluctant, but the boy held the half-hewn piece of wood up and bid the centurion to listen. The soldier laughed nervously and then put his ear to the wood. He closed his eyes. Joseph studied the man's face. What was that? Humility? Peace? The soldier put down the wood and slowly began to work, not nearly as deftly as the boy, but the wood began to curl and fall away. Coming back to Nazareth should have been joyous. Called out from their captivity in Egypt by the glimmering voice of an angel, back into the land of their inheritance, a leader for a revolution. And then, back in Nazareth, crickets. No seas parted their waters, no trumpets or great throngs greeted them. The call of God thrust them again into the throes of ordinary life. So Jesus whittles rough edges. He binds cracks and makes joins. He fetches water and raises chickens and washes dishes. He goes to synagogue and listens to the Torah. He buries his father. He stays up late, deciding whether to pay the rent or buy food for the week, whether to get a loan at 300% interest to keep the heat on or to tell the kids to bundle up, whether to question the authorities when they profile him and pull him over for no good reason and risk being shot, or to be humiliated and jailed without a cause. He's wrongfully accused, beaten, convicted, and even killed. And in all of this, Jesus was compassionate and provocative and gentle and fiery and innovative and calming and frustrated and patient and stubborn and generous and hopeful and distressed and loud and silent and unimpressed and awed. He was not bound to religious perfectionism or public approval. And Jesus is calling us out of captivity. Jesus is calling us to freedom, freedom from bigotry and prejudice, freedom from self-loathing and pride, freedom from the need to please the crowds or tantalize the trendsetters, freedom from the prison of power, freedom from the chains of greed, freedom from the blindness of racism, freedom from the sickness of self-preservation. Now, maybe in this list, you're just hearing another standard you can't live up to. Well, that's what I heard at first. And immediately, I'm off the hook. I can't do it. Oh, well. Jesus was perfect, and I'm not. But being imperfect isn't the problem. Failing isn't the problem. Looking like an idiot isn't the problem. And having to apologize isn't the problem. Hiding under a bushel, that's the problem. So be like Franco. Transform bars and gates into beautiful reminders of freedom. You know, he did all that work for free because he loved his community. He wanted to make his street a better place. And when asked why he did it, he said, "Nothing that you do for love and beauty is ever lost. So don't be afraid. Jesus is calling you out of hiding. He's calling you out of your bonds and your fears. He's not interested in your perfect performance. And he's not asking for your rigid observance of every rule and regulation. He's calling out your very best self, your essential identity, to come to the surface, to shed the fear and shame, to come to the light, knots and quirks and sins and imperfections. Because this is not the time to hide in the shadows. This is not the time to slink back into the safety of anonymity. This is not the time to let voices of hate and fear and prejudice sound louder than the voices of love and compassion and justice. It may not be glamorous. It may not make the headlines, but it will be beautiful." Mary couldn't sleep. The songs of angels and the smell of barns and the crying of infants and the murmuring of shepherds and the hushed voices of foreign dignitaries, the hissing of sand underfoot, all sounded together and congealed in her mind. It was an odd sound at first, but the parts began to fall into time together. The swoosh of glittering robes and the thud of donkey feet, the scraping of chisels and the rushing waters of the Nile. It was an odd mix of sounds. Nothing she would have come up with on her own. But it was beautiful.